in a particular system. Now, we do have certain, you know, illogical beliefs regarding this. We don't want to get into that. But what is known that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the one who has created a perfect system, and the system will continue by the will of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So for example, one of the verses that Imam mentions is this beautiful verse. And he says that he has subjugated night and day, the sun and the moon for your benefit. And the stars have been subjugated by his command. Indeed, there is a sign in this for people who use their intellect. لِقَوْمٍ يَأَقِلُونَ. So here we see that this verse is very similar to the previous one that we mentioned. But here, it is showing that these are blessings for you to make use of them and to think about it. That these are blessings that I have been given by who? Who has given me these blessings? And by thinking upon a person will realize that no, there is a manager, a person who is in control of these blessings. They have been put there for a specific purpose. They're not there just for fun. So one of, and again, the Imam mentions eight or seven other verses in this section. Obviously, we don't have time to go all through all the verses. So I recommend my dear brothers and sisters to follow up in this section 3 of this tradition. Inshallah, until next time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Kashmir is one of the most beautiful regions in the world, but continues to be in crisis. Now, the region has had an uncertain future since 1947, with the partition of India. Both Pakistan and India have claimed the area, as well as a smaller part by China, and the United Nations ruled that a plebiscite must be carried out. However, New Delhi has refused to allow the region to vote, and 18 months ago, India tightened its grip on Kashmir, revoking Article 370, which had given the region semi-autonomy. And the situation continues to deteriorate and be unresolved. Stay with us as we take a look at the latest in the region of Kashmir on this debate.
These people are marching on the streets to show support to the people of Kashmir. This rally in Islamabad is part of a series of events in Pakistan organized to mark the Kashmir Solidarity Day. Pakistan observes the day every year on the 5th of February. Pakistan's foreign minister led the rally in Islamabad and urged the international community to play a role in ending the suffering of the people of Kashmir.
The purpose of our today's rally is to express solidarity with the people of Kashmir. The people of Kashmir have been under siege for last 18 months. But we want to make it clear that India cannot suppress the freedom of Kashmir forever.
Kashmir has remained under lockdown since August 5, 2019, when India revoked its special status. Thousands of people have been detained, and over 8 million Kashmiris have little access to the outside world.
We are thankful to the people of Pakistan and the government for supporting us. We are hopeful that Pakistan would continue to support us till Kashmir is liberated from India.
We must understand as the Kashmiris are living under an occupation and oppression for the past 73 years. And the 5th of February marks a day where we, people of Pakistan particularly, tell the Kashmiris living across the line of control that they are not alone.
Pakistan and India have competing claims on the long-standing Jammu and Kashmir issue. Both claim the region in full but rule on parts of it. They have fought wars over Kashmir, where tensions continue to increase. There is a fear of yet another conflict on the dispute between the two neighbors. The country's prime minister visited the Pakistani-administered Kashmir to mark the day.
Prime Minister Imran Khan says Pakistan is ready to take two steps forward if India is willing to seek a political settlement of the long-standing Kashmir dispute. However, given the current hostilities between the two neighbors, experts believe there is a slim chance of any dialogue on Kashmir, at least in the near future. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
I'd like to welcome my guest to the program, Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Mr. Zafar Bangash, out of Toronto, and Kashmir Institute for International Affairs, Muzammil Ayub Thakir, President of the World Kashmir Freedom Movement out of London. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start it off in Toronto, and Zafar, why do you think that in August of 2019, India revoked the limited autonomy that it had given the region? What was the goal of that?
Well, ever since the current regime in India came to power under Narendra Modi, he follows a very extremist, racist ideology of Hindutva, which basically negates the rights of all minorities, even inside India, let alone in Kashmir. And Kashmir, of course, as in the introduction it was pointed out, had enjoyed a special status since the Indian forces illegally occupied it in October of 1947. We need to step back a little bit and understand that according to the partition plan of 1947, Muslim majority areas were to constitute the state of Pakistan, and Hindu majority areas were to go with India. Now, Kashmir was and remains a Muslim majority area, but it had a Hindu ruler, and regrettably, while the people of Kashmir wanted to become part of Pakistan, the ruler, through a sleight of hand, what is referred to as the instrument of accession, it was a temporary measure. He went with India, but India pledged at that time that the wishes of the people would be respected. There were, in fact, 11 Security Council resolutions that called for a referendum in Kashmir. Initially, India promised that it would abide by those resolutions. Now it has backed out of it. And because India feels that it is militarily more powerful, it has a Hindu nationalist government in power, that they do not recognize the rights of the Kashmiri people, and we see this crisis that intensified on August the 5th of 2019.
Well, Muzammil, what do you think? What does India want by pressuring this region? As the guest in Toronto said, that region is a majority Muslim region. With the various declarations from the United Nations and saying that they should be able to vote on their status, whether they want to be a part of Pakistan or India or independent. But India isn't allowing that. What is India after exactly by what it's doing?
It's a very good question. I think we need to, it's something that your guest touched upon. It's a neo-colonial imperialist expansionist program of settler colonialism and demographic change. That's exactly what India wants to do. And if these terms sound familiar, that's because it is familiar. It's exactly what the Nazis had suggested and what they talked about when they performed the Holocaust and when they were against the Jews. And these people, the BJP is backed by the RSS. The RSS is a parent organization, designated terrorist organization in the past. It was even banned in India in the 40s and in the late 40s. It's the same organization that took responsibility for the killing of Mohandas, or rather what other people call Mahatma Gandhi. So you understand what kind of organization this is. And their entire agenda, which they openly accept, is an expansionist program. They openly admire Hitler. They openly claim to take a direction from the Nazi Germany handbook. and their entire agenda is Akhand Bharat. The term they use is Akhand Bharat, a pan-Hindu nation, one party, one nation, one ideology. And that's exactly what they want to do. And there's so much proof of this in their own literature and in the media that exists in India. The BJP has become a reason for fanaticism. It's easier to radicalize people in India because of the lack of literacy and the lack of information that exists, and the fact that they are not as quite well-informed as the rest of the international counterparts. So they are easily more radicalized, the same way exactly how the Germans did under the Nazis. So we have to recognize exactly what they want to do and why they're doing it. Kashmir is part of the bigger program. After Kashmir, they started tampering with the CAA and the NRC bills. These are citizen amendmentship acts in India, basically discriminatory acts against Muslims and minorities. That's right after they meddled with Article 370 and 35A, revoking the special status of Kashmir. And now we're seeing the farmers' protests as well. So it's not historical agendas or assumptions of what's going to happen. These are happening in real time right now. And one simple example that I want to give is how the Indian government, particularly the BJP, the RSS, they term some of these locations. So for example, Mecca, the Holy Kaaba in Mecca, they call it Makeshwar Mahadev Temple. I mean, this is what I mean when I talk about expansionist programs to create a pan-Hindu nation.
Well, Zafar, if you agree with our guest in London, why is there such silence from the international community? Because if it's true what he said, our analyst said, and that there is a racist agenda behind this, and of course the type of abuse that the Indian government is being accused of inflicting on the Kashmir region, why aren't we hearing more from the so-called international agencies?
Well, this has to do with the geostrategic interests of various powers. Right now, what we see is that the United States is targeting China because China is an emerging economic and military power, and China has also expanded its geostrategic reach into the Central Asian and the broader Eurasian landmass. And of course, Pakistan is closely aligned with China, whereas the United States and its Western allies are using India to target China and to frustrate China's plans. So you would see not only what India is doing, the atrocities and the crimes that India is perpetrating in Kashmir, as well as in the rest of India, incidentally, as Muzamil pointed out, that the Muslims are being targeted. They constitute 185 million people in India, but these draconian laws, the Citizenship Amendment Act and other acts that they have introduced, and the Hindu Nazis are openly declaring that India is only, if people want to stay here, they can only stay here as Hindus, not as any other religion. So not just Muslims, but even Christians are being targeted, but the rest of the world is remaining silent because they want to use India for their geostrategic purposes, and so they overlook it. Now, if you go beyond India, you look at the Zionist state of Israel, whose policy, of course, India is following to the letter. Mm-hmm. Again, the atrocities that the Zionists perpetrate against the Palestinian people are not really addressed because Zionist Israel is seen as a beachhead in the Muslim world that is used by the West, particularly now, of course, the United States, that uses Israel to, in fact, keep that entire region destabilized. So what we are seeing is a geostrategic chess game that is going on, in which the United States want to checkmate China and, of course, beyond that, Russia, and they see India as a partner with them. Mm-hmm. Although I want to point out that the West is going to be greatly disappointed. India will not be able to fulfill the desires of the West because China definitely is emerging its march towards economic development, and its military power cannot be checked. Of course, China is not going to be a rival to the United States militarily within the next maybe 5 to 10 years, but beyond that it will be. But economically, there are already World Bank studies, IMF studies, and other studies that indicate that China is in fact going to supersede the United States economically by the year 2028. So it is in order to undermine China's rise that the rest of the world is remaining silent to the gross atrocities and crimes that the Indian regime is perpetrating. But I just also want to add one more point,
mm-hmm.
that while it may be able to get away with it for now, I think the way history works and operates is that criminals are ultimately brought to justice. We saw yesterday the International Criminal Court in The Hague actually ruled that it has jurisdiction to investigate Israeli war crimes,
right,
in Gaza as well as in the West Bank and and Jerusalem, etc. So I think it's a warning that the Indian rulers should take heed of, because a day will come, a day of reckoning, when their crimes will also be brought to trial, and
okay.
these Indian rulers will be held accountable.
Okay. Your thoughts, Mozambique, because as Zafar said, a day is reckoning is near, but also in his analysis of things, especially with the part that it's a chess game by the United States, by the West, and trying to limit China and also Russia. If that is the case, it appears that the situation is going to deteriorate before getting better in Kashmir. How do you see it?
Well, it's pretty accurate. We've seen the lockdown, obviously the conventional lockdown that we've seen because of COVID, and people's understandings or starting to understand what exactly COVID means and what exactly a lockdown means. In Kashmir, this is a completely different situation. It's been much, much worse. Deaths, rapes, enforced disappearances, human shields. I mean, it's a huge list of war crimes that India commits inside occupied Kashmir, and it's been exponentially growing. And now we've seen measures where they are issuing domicile certificates to non-residents, essentially changing the demography of the area. And once that happens, the indigenous people will no longer have a place to stay. We've seen this with the Rohingya. We're seeing this with the Palestinians. And this is exactly what happens when a settler colonial empire, somebody that wants to be an empire, these are the kind of tactics they use. In terms of the larger scheme of things, there is an implosion within India at this moment, particularly after the Article 370 and 35A being revoked, but also the CAA and the NRC. And I keep on referring back to this because the minorities started to stand up. They finally understood what the Kashmiris were talking about when we said that if you don't stand up for us today, tomorrow they're going to come for you. And even then, that kind of slow process of protesting and trying to vilify the BJP government, it still didn't quite take as much, it didn't pick up as much pace as it should have until the farmers' protest happened. And that has been a big stumbling block for the Indian government, where it seems like potentially that they may need to retract that position. But ultimately, what needs to happen is, as Mr. Bangash said, is that the world powers need to somehow intervene. But until and unless they recognize India as the emerging power, they want to sponsor India as the emerging power in that area, we won't see much development and much change. We've recently, of course, seen the Chinese incursion into Ladakh, claiming that territory for their own, essentially putting up a fight against the Indians. And we haven't really seen much of a reaction from the Indian government, mainly because they can't really push back against a formidable foe. But in that sense, the situation in Kashmir will exponentially get worse, and that is expected. But ultimately, what we're expecting, people like myself from Indian-occupied Kashmir, we're expecting that the international community does intervene, the ICJ does intervene, that the United Nations observers at least go into Kashmir, because they're able to go into the Pakistani side of Kashmir and have unfettered access. Whereas in Indian-occupied Kashmir, that just doesn't happen. And of course, we know about Amnesty International being banned from India for reporting on Kashmir, and there are many other organizations as well. So we do, I am expecting things to get worse, and that isn't something easy to say, because I have family there. I still have family there. My cousins are in jail. My uncle just recently died, and I can't go visit, and that's despite the COVID. So there are, this is real life politics. This is real life people's hearts and souls being entwined in this conflict and not being able to do anything. And looking at the West and seeing the kind of rights and liberties that exist for them, and yet they are, for some reason, they seem to be outlandish for the people of Kashmir when we ask for exactly the same thing. I'll probably end with this point. The fact that the farmers' controversy in communists inside India, the common people are now standing up for rights. They use the term occupation, oppression, freedoms and liberties. They use these terms, but it is hypocritical. The Indian government, for all their faults, they have made apparent the hypocrisy within India and the double standards that exist for them and for the people of Kashmir, clearly identifying that the people of Kashmir are not technically and never have been, and nor do they ever want to be, Indians.
Well, Mazamil, staying with you, actually, I want to just briefly touch on, for our viewers, the current situation now in Kashmir. We know that 18 months ago this crackdown was initiated, was cut off, basically, the region cut off from the world. I want you to give us a minute update on the current situation right now, the day-to-day life for people in that region now. What is it like?
With a curfew, you can imagine that you're not allowed to go outside. Communication blockades, media blackouts, nobody understanding what is actually going on, not being able to visit your own family and relatives. And then on top of that, you have another lockdown because of COVID, which makes it even worse because of fear of transmission of disease. But we've seen over the last however many months, the people of Kashmir not having access to food, to water, to medicine, to healthcare. Women that have had to give still births on the roads because the military, the occupational forces, wouldn't allow them to go to hospitals. People that have died have not been able to take funeral processions, so the dead have had to be buried in the backyard, in the gardens. We've heard about young children being pelleted. 18-month-old Hiba, she was 18 months old, sitting in her mother's lap, pelleted by the Indian army, and now she's blind in one eye. We have so many different cases inside Kashmir of war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, ethnic cleansing. Now we're seeing demographic change and settler colonialism. The crisis in Kashmir has reached its tipping point, and I would go as far as to say that it is as bad as Syria, Palestine, Afghanistan, Iraq, and all the other conflicts put together, mainly because of the lack of attention and the lack of intervention.
Zafar, what is it going to take to change that around? He talked about the lack of attention to bring this issue up front to the world. And what is it going to take? We talked about international community. Also, in the international community, we have billions of Muslims and independent people thinking. What will it take to bring them together in order to try to put pressure on New Delhi?
Well, first of all, I think awareness of the true situation in Indian-occupied Kashmir is absolutely vital. And as yesterday, we saw that Kashmir Solidarity Day was observed not only in Pakistan, but throughout the world, incidentally. Right here in Canada, for instance, we had a webinar on Kashmir Solidarity Day. There have been similar webinars in the United States, in Europe, and elsewhere, which means that there is now awareness about the Kashmir situation emerging. Secondly, I want to take you back to June 2018 as well as July of 2019. The United Nations High Commission for Human Rights issued two reports. These were actually extremely critical of India's behavior towards the oppression of the Kashmiri people. And so it indicates that there is some awareness emerging. But as I said, I think ultimately what it needs is a concerted campaign of boycott and sanctions against India. And I think in this respect, the civil society groups all over the world can play a very significant role. Whether it's in Canada, the United States, Europe, these are important countries with which India trades. And I think if India's pocket is hit, I think it will then begin to take heed. As Muzamil pointed out, there are actually people now inside India that are waking up to the reality of the fascism that is sweeping India. And I think if more and more people were to become aware of this and mobilized, I think India can be forced to give up its very oppressive policies. And you asked about the Muslim world.
30 seconds. Go ahead.
Probably about 1.82 billion Muslims. Regrettably, Muslims are unfortunately quite divided, but I think there is an enlightened group of Muslims all around the world that feel deeply for the suffering of Muslims in any part of the world. For instance, the Palestinians, the Rohingyas, the people in Iraq or Iran or Syria or Yemen, etc. So I think there is hope from the Muslims as well. What we need to do is to increase our efforts and to bring awareness of this very, very tragic situation in Kashmir.
Indeed. And on that note, I thank both of you being with us on this debate. Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Mr. Zafar Bangash, out of Toronto, Canada. And from the Kashmir Institute of International Affairs, Mr. Mozammil Ayub Thakir, President of World Kashmir Freedom Movement, out of London. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll discuss the 22nd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Hajj, or Pilgrimage. Before moving on, let's just listen to some verses of this chapter, and we'll be back with you. Stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
Alam ta'lam anna Allah ya'lamu ma fis sama'i wal ardh inna dhalika fi kitab inna dhalika 'ala Allahi yasir.
Do you not know that Allah knows what is in the heaven and earth? Indeed, that is in a record. Indeed, that for Allah is easy.
The 70th verse of the chapter starts saying, أَلَمْ تَعْلَمْ أَنَّ اللَّهَ يَعْلَمُ مَا فِي السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ. Do you not know that Allah knows what is in the heaven and the earth? إِنَّ ذَلِكَ فِي كِتَابٍ إِنَّ ذَلِكَ عَلَى اللَّهِ يَسِيرٌ. Verily, this is in a book, and verily, this is easy for Allah. You may remember prior to this verse, we talked about the two previous verses of the chapter, where the Almighty Allah says that He knows best what some people do, which is referring to those people who were disbelievers. And as a result, he was the best judge for the day of judgment. He will judge between you on the day of judgment, the verse says. Allahu yahkumu baynakum yawm al-qiyamah. And in this verse, it continues saying that أَلَمْ تَعْلَمْ أَنَّ اللَّهَ يَعْلَمُ مَا فِي السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ. Do you not know that Allah knows all which is in the heaven and the earth? Allah's knowledge is the same with respect to all of the world of existence. And since the judgment in hereafter upon the deeds of human beings and their discords actually needs a vast knowledge unto all of them, in this verse, the Quran hinting to the infinite knowledge of Allah says, أَلَمْ تَعْلَمْ أَنَّ اللَّهَ يَعْلَمُ مَا فِي السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ. Do you not know that Allah knows what is in the heaven and the earth?
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
Everything is recorded in a book. Inna dhalika fi kitab. Verily, this is in a book, which means this is recorded in a book. And this is the book of the infinite knowledge of Allah. It is the book of the world of existence and the world of cause and effect, a world where actually nothing will be lost or perished, but the things always change in forms. Even the waves of the weak sound which a mortal did produce thousands of years ago have not been annihilated or extinguished completely, and they do exist in the atmosphere. And the Almighty Allah is the one that knows them all. This is a very consistent book in which everything has been recorded. In other words, all these things are found in the protected tablet, the tablet of the knowledge of Allah. And all these beings, with all their characteristics, all their details, are all present with Him. And this is actually what makes Him the best judge for the day of judgment. Allahu yahkumu baynakum yawm al-qiyamah. The 69th verse used to say, Allah will judge you on the day of judgment. And one of the reasons the Almighty Allah is the best judge is that He knows what is in the heaven and what is in the earth. The Almighty Allah's knowledge, all the things we do, all the things changing forms in this universe, are all recorded in that protected tablet. And that is why, actually, in the last sentence of this verse, the Quran announces that this is easy for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because all beings entirely,
with older qualities attend before him. The verse says, verily this is recorded in a book, إِنَّ ذَلِكَ فِي كِتَابٍ, and it continues saying, إِنَّ ذَلِكَ عَلَى اللَّهِ يَسِيرٌ, verily this is easy for Almighty Allah. So the sovereignty of the Almighty Allah, the control He has for everything and everyone, is recorded in that book, and it is easy for the Almighty Allah. But the point is that we have to know and understand this from the bottom of our hearts. The Messenger of the Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, having knowledge to Allah is the best of deeds, for knowing Him will benefit you, whether the deed is scanty or abundant. And verily, ignorance will not benefit you, whether the deed is scanty or abundant. And also, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam has said in this regard, the finite of knowledge to Allah is being in awe of Allah, the pure. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
First revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals, is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
Around the world with reporters.
There are many EU legislators who depict Russia as a dangerous adversary that needs to be restrained. They condemn the imprisonment of opposition figure Alexei Navalny and the handling of protests in Russia.
The European Union needs to send a message by not only considering new sanctions, but also by increasing our support to prosecuted, tortured, and repressed voices of the opposition and the civil society.
It's rarely highlighted by mainstream media in the West that Navalny received a prison sentence last month after returning to Russia for breaking the terms of a 2014 suspended prison sentence. Also, Western media never mentioned the global pandemic when reporting on public protests in Russia organized by Navalny supporters. Just last weekend, 500 protesters were arrested here in Brussels, and those detained made claims of police brutality. Mainstream media vilify demonstrators here and in other Western nations for breaking COVID-19 rules, while at the same time portraying protesters in Russia as heroes. The EU and US accused the Russian government of poisoning Alexei Navalny last August. Navalny was treated in Germany after the alleged murder attempt. The Kremlin denies any role and is clearly unhappy that EU authorities refuse to provide medical evidence.
It is quite impolite, mildly speaking, and it is such arrogance from cultural Europe. It seems to me unacceptable, and we categorically reject it.
There are many reasons why Brussels should try to improve relations with Moscow, some EU lawmakers insist.
Well, Russia is a capital neighbor. We cannot ignore that the longest neighbor, the longest border, it is with Russia. Russia is not only, an energy supplier. It's as well a strategic relation.
A good case in point, a number of EU nations are now scrambling to get their hands on Russia's Sputnik V COVID-19 vaccine, which is more than 90% efficacious. The EU has major vaccine supply issues. Moscow says it's happy to help. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
People are marching on the streets to show support to the people of Kashmir. This rally in Islamabad is part of a series of events in Pakistan organized to mark the Kashmir Solidarity Day. Pakistan observes the day every year on the 5th of February. Pakistan's foreign minister led the rally in Islamabad and urged the international community to play a role in ending the suffering of the people of Kashmir.
The purpose of our today's rally is to express solidarity with the people of Kashmir. The people of Kashmir have been under siege for the last 18 months. But we want to make it clear that India cannot suppress the freedom of Kashmir forever.
Kashmir has remained under lockdown since August 5, 2019, when India revoked its special status. Thousands of people have been detained, and over 8 million Kashmiris have little access to the outside world.
We are thankful to the people of Pakistan and the government for supporting us. We are hopeful that Pakistan would continue to support us till Kashmir is liberated from India.
We must understand as the Kashmiris are living under an occupation and oppression for the past 73 years. And the 5th of February marks a day where we, the people of Pakistan particularly, tell the Kashmiris living across the line of control that they are not alone.
Pakistan and India have competing claims on the long-standing Jammu and Kashmir issue. Both claim the region in full but rule on parts of it. They have fought wars over Kashmir, where tensions continue to increase. There is a fear of yet another conflict on the dispute between the two neighbors. The country's prime minister visited the Pakistani-administered Kashmir to mark the day.
Prime Minister Imran Khan says Pakistan is ready to take two steps forward if India is willing to seek a political settlement of the long-standing Kashmir dispute. However, given the current hostilities between the two neighbors, experts believe there is a slim chance of any dialogue on Kashmir, at least in the near future. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Boazaji University continue protesting the appointment of AKP-affiliated rector. University academics turned their back to the newly appointed rector's office as a symbol of objection. The academics called for the resignation of Melih Bulu, the rector that was appointed by Turkish president. Protests have been going for weeks now, with police arresting hundreds. Demonstrations broke out early January when Turkish president appointed Melih Bulu, an academic with strong ties with the ruling party, as the new rector for Boğaziçi University. Students and academics complained that the appointment broke a decade-long tradition of Boğaziçi rectors being elected from within the university academic team. The Boğaziçi crisis gathered support from other universities and oppositions, who saw in this new trial from the president to force control over the country after granting himself sweeping powers post-coup attempt in 2016. Erdogan said the protests are not led by students. claiming it is stamped by opposition parties.
A segment of politics is leading the way for this. It is not possible to describe and accept the protests as incidents about the university students. Turkey's opposition parties, including main opposition, Republican People's Party and E Party, as well as People's Democratic Party, are behind all of this.
Turkish president also slammed the US and France over their reaction to the protest, mentioning the incidents taking place ahead of US elections and calling French President Macron to take care of the Yellow Vest protests in his country before pointing fingers to what is happening in Turkey. Erdogan argued that the law grants the president the authority to appoint rectors and that he had done it before in other universities.
The whole issue broke out after president appointed the new rector. This is not against the law, but the problem is that Melih Blue isn't an academic and this is against the law. I disagree that the protests were driven by political parties. It started by students. Of course, opposition parties are taking advantage of the protests to lash out at the president.
The government response to the protest came harsh, as peaceful protests have been met with overwhelming violence and arrests. Critics and human rights activists say those are efforts by Erdogan to seize more power using the coup plot as a scarecrow. The Boğaziçi protest brings to mind the huge Gezi Park protest held years ago, with many saying that it will continue because the problem is in the system itself. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Tensions between Beijing and Washington escalated once again, this time after the U.S. guided missile destroyer USS John McCain sailed through the Taiwan Strait despite repeated objections from China. The transit was the first such move since the inauguration of Joe Biden as U.S. president. The U.S. Navy claimed the move demonstrates Washington's, quote, commitment to a free and open Indo-Pacific, saying that the U.S. military would, quote, continue to fly, sail, and operate anywhere international law allows. Beijing, however, considers any passing through the waterway as provocative and a breach of its sovereignty. It says such operations threaten stability in the region and embolden separatists on the self-ruled island. China is also strongly against deepening ties between Washington and Taipei since it sees Taiwan as part of its territory. It has repeatedly called on the United States to respect the One China policy and stop interfering in the country's internal affairs. Taiwan, however, views itself an independent territory. The previous U.S. administration under Donald Trump tried to bolster Taiwan's international standing by sending several high-level envoys to the island. It also approved sales of sophisticated weapons to Taipei, including F-16 fighter jets and advanced missiles. The moves drew strong condemnation from China and caused relations between the two countries to sink to the lowest level in decades. With Biden taking the helm at the White House, there was some optimism that Washington-Beijing ties would improve. However, it so appears that there is no end to the downward spiral. Experts believe Biden is also using Taiwan as a playing card against China.
The Biden administration, despite having quite a bit of experience, is treating Taiwan like it's a playing card. Unfortunately, on the Chinese side, it's not a playing card, it's a red line. So these are the type of very dangerous situations which can, in fact, lead to an armed conflict.
Taiwan is one of the multiple fronts in the Sino-American standoff. The dueling economic powers have been at loggerheads over a host of issues. The U.S. has recently blacklisted several Chinese officials over a new security law in Hong Kong that Washington claims to be against freedom of speech. China, however, says the law will return stability to the economic hub that has been embroiled in anti-government protests for months. China accuses the U.S. and other Western countries of being behind the protests. Washington has also sided with Beijing's rivals in the maritime dispute over the South China Sea and routinely dispatches warships and warplanes to the region. The two sides are also involved in a bitter trade and cyber wars. During Trump's presidency, the U.S. imposed sweeping tariffs on Chinese imports, prompting tit-for-tat measures from China. Experts believe that there is a bipartisan anti-China sentiment among U.S. politicians.
There's a bipartisan anti-China feeling, not only among the American people, but also in Congress.
The recent moves and statements from the Biden administration suggest that tensions between Beijing and Washington are far from over. Biden's policy on China has so far proven to be different from that of Trump's administration, only in rhetoric, not in kind. ¶¶
Jobs and working conditions are much more in danger today than in normal times. That's why the main French trade unions called for a nationwide strike and demonstrations in order to defend jobs, salaries and working conditions. The COVID crisis is leading to an important loss of jobs and to an explosion of poverty. Trade union leaders call for a social spring.
The social spring is a formula we use to say that the social question cannot be denied in this difficult period. So the anger we notice every day in the enterprises should find an expression. We want our demands to be heard.
These workers of the big French multinational Total are threatened with dismissal, despite financial support from the state. Other big companies in France, such as the pharmaceutical Sanofi, car constructors Renault and PSA, and Airbus also benefit from important tax reductions and financial aid from the government, but that does not prevent them to fire workers.
Sanofi receives about 120 million euros every year for research. They pay less taxes and they are going to pay 4 billion euros to their shareholders. Today they announced a record of their profits. Meanwhile, they are firing workers and they did not find a vaccine. There is a problem.
France has not been able to produce its own vaccine, unlike the USA, Russia, China, and even Cuba. A big disappointment for French people. Experts say it's due to the continuous privatization. Scientific research has been sacrificed for short-term profits.
We can't continue with the pharmaceutical industry that's making a huge amount of profits without investing their benefits in research for the general interest. Public research has to be maintained. The fact that Sanofi has not been able to produce a vaccine reveals a real problem in the system.
According to the National Institute for Economic Studies, INSEE, the French gross domestic product, GDP, went down with more than 8% in 2020. Less than expected, but still a record since the Second World War. Unemployment increased with 8%. Nevertheless, the main French companies are making more profits today than before the COVID crisis. Profits for few, sacrifices for many.
It's difficult to organize workers during lockdowns and curfews. Fundamental liberties are put in danger with the COVID crisis. A united front, as shown today in France, is one of the means to go forward. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
Senior leaders of combined opposition parties, including Pakistan People's Party and Muslim League of former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, gathered in Islamabad to decide new course of action after opposition's deadline to Prime Minister Imran Khan to resign expired. After hours-long meeting, they announced that people from all over Pakistan would start a mass long march towards the capital Islamabad on March 26 this year to force the government of Prime Minister Imran Khan to step down and hold fresh general elections. The opposition blames the military to have rigged general elections in favor of Prime Minister Imran Khan in 2018.
We are struggling to get rid of an illegitimate government which was formed through rigging in general elections. We are trying to restore the sanctity of the public mandate.
A better sense must prevail among the opposition parties. The opposition must understand that their protests would not bring down our government. When we were in the opposition, we held protest rallies in Islamabad for 126 days to bring down the government.
The opposition launched a public mobilization campaign late last year across Pakistan to prepare people for the long march next month, something which government believes received a lackluster response. Prime Minister Imran Khan says that the opposition parties turned against him after he rejected their backdoor request to stop prosecuting top opposition leaders on corruption charges. The opposition's decision to start a mass long march has come after anti-graft watchdog started prosecuting top opposition leaders on money laundering charges. The former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif has already been convicted on money laundering charges.
Analysts believe that the opposition parties enjoy little public support after their top leaders were tainted with the corruption charges. However, discontentment prevailed among people over unprecedented price hike after Pakistan devalued its currency under IMF pressure, something opposition failed to exploit in its favor. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
February 4th is World Cancer Day, and on this day, thousands of Gazan cancer patients suffer immensely due to the crippling Israeli blockade. After being diagnosed with cancer, patients in Gaza have to wait for months before being able to receive treatment. Gaza hospitals suffer from acute shortage of medicines, especially for cancer patients. Getting an Israeli permit to access the health care needed outside the impoverished enclave can be a stressful and unpredictable process, and many apply multiple times before being able to exit.
Israel usually doesn't allow Palestinian patients to travel through the Erez crossing despite having an exit permit. They only need to leave the Gaza Strip to receive required treatments.
Currently, cancer patients in Gaza suffer acute shortage of the essential drugs needed for their treatment with a 50% deficit rate. Despite the high number of cancer cases in Gaza, the Israeli regime also refuses to allow spare parts for radiation therapy machines to enter Gaza.
Radiation therapy, especially for breast cancer patients, is not available in the Gaza Strip, and patients must go to hospitals in Israel or the occupied West Bank for treatment. Radiation therapy is a hard process and takes a very long time to get an Israeli permit for such procedures. Oftentimes, cancer patients miss their hospital appointments due to delayed exit permits.
There are around 14,000 cancer patients in the Gaza Strip, 47% male and 53% female. Breast cancer is the most commonly diagnosed cancer among females. Cancer patients have also complained of humiliating treatment at the Israeli-controlled Erez crossing.
The process in the Israeli crossing is extremely humiliating because they insist on strip searching you. I was very sick and they kept interrogating me for 3 hours and then they began to strip search me. I told them that I had a mastectomy, but the Israelis did not let me go through until they did a full body search.
Under the current circumstances, the health condition of many cancer patients is likely to further deteriorate. Human rights organizations in the Gaza Strip have repeatedly urged the international community to help bring an end to the Israeli blockade and save the lives of cancer patients. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
According to the International Organization for Migration, at least 600 families were forcibly displaced from their homes in Yemen in January due to the increasing confrontations in several governorates of the country.
The areas controlled by the Saudi-led coalition suffer from instability, insecurity, and the spread of armed groups. Therefore, the residents of these areas are leaving to save their lives from missiles, projectiles, and armed confrontations. These have all been confirmed by the international organizations, including IOM.
The IOM says Al-Hudaydah, Al-Dale, and Taiz governorates have the highest number of displaced people. As the war continues in these areas, most displacements occurred during the last week of January, indicating that 2021 may witness more of this crisis.
The issue of displacement can only be solved by lifting the imposed siege. Those displaced greatly suffer from the absence of support from international organizations. These people must be among the priorities of the humanitarian operations. It is shameful to see an increase in the number of displaced people in 2021 due to the continuing armed conflicts.
Millions of families had to leave their homes for survival since the beginning of the war in Yemen in 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war on the Arab country, killing thousands of civilians, including women and the children. 2021 doesn't seem to be better than the previous years for Yemenis, as the war continues to create new difficulties for thousands of people who had to migrate for their lives. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has signaled that it is willing to return to the 2015 nuclear deal from which former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally exited in 2018 and reimposed anti-Tehran sanctions. But 2 weeks after taking the helm at the White House, Washington's return to the agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, still hangs in the balance. The U.S. says Iran should first come back to full compliance with the accord, but Tehran says it was Washington that walked away and hence it should fulfill all its obligations, which include the lifting of all sanctions. Amid the standoff, Iran's foreign minister warned that the Biden administration has a limited window of opportunity to re-enter the agreement. He, meanwhile, suggested the question over who must take the first step in returning to the JCPOA could be resolved by EU foreign policy chief Joseph Borrell.
He can put his hat as the coordinator of the joint position and sort of choreograph the actions that are